My name is Mike, and I'm from Chicago. It's a very brief biography or whatever. I work with Anti-Racist Action. Should I start? My name is Mike, and I'm from Chicago. It's a very brief biography or whatever. I work with Anti-Racist Action in Chicago, who helped publish this book, The Confronting Fascism book. I also am in the editorial collective for Arsenal Magazine, which comes out of Chicago. And I'm part of the BRIC Collective, which is a member collective of the relatively new Federation of Revolutionary Anarchist Collectives of the Great Lakes region. And I do lots of other stuff on the side as well, but those are sort of the three main projects I'm working on right now. And I had agreed to talk today. The proposal that I made for the workshop was on anti-fascism and anti, in parentheses, nationalism, which I'm sure raised some eyebrows in the group deciding on workshops and also in people looking at the listings of workshops. As it happens, when I was drafting stuff to say, a lot of the nationalism stuff got crowded out by other things that I wanted to say. I'm more than willing to talk about that in the question and answer discussion period, I guess. I think I have about a half hour of sort of prepared stuff. And in there is maybe 5 minutes of stuff on nationalism. But everything else is definitely related. It all fits together. So to begin, I wanted to sort of encourage people to do a thought experiment. I want people to think back to the Great Depression and to World War II, which is the time in the 20th century when capitalism was in perhaps one of its greatest crises and fascism was on its biggest upswing. And I want you to think about the weird alliances that developed in that time and how many sorts of strange bedfellows there were. Think about the Hitler-Stalin Pact, for instance, or about syndicalist support for Mussolini. Think about militant anti-fascists in the European underground resistance during World War II, which was often dominated by Stalinists, but more often than not received significant aid from and provided assistance to British and U.S. forces in World War II. Think about radicals in North America who were really badly split between people who were openly encouraging enlistment in the fight against fascism and people who went to prison for not only refusing the draft but for encouraging others to refuse the draft. And think about the weird twists and turns of Peronism in Argentina or the green wing or the left wing of the Nazi Party in Germany or about the weakness of the European left in dealing with Italian occupation in Ethiopia, or the twists and turns of East Asian resistance to Japanese occupation. There are all sorts of very interesting and complex scenarios, I think, in that time frame. And from our perspective, in the beginning of the 21st century, a lot of these alliances are pretty easily scoffed at or dismissed or rejected outright, but others are not so easily done away with, I think. For instance, you know, would you have enlisted in the army to fight against the Nazis? Would you have participated in the French or Dutch or Italian resistance, if you're an anarchist, knowing that those resistance movements are largely dominated by Stalinists because you're a militant anti-fascist? Would you have encouraged draft resistance in Canada or in the United States during World War II? And I don't have clear answers to those sorts of questions. And I think actually that people who feel like they do have probably not thought through a lot of the implications of those questions, because I think they are really tough. But as hard as it is to answer those sorts of questions, I think we really need to start trying to think them through and bring them up to date into a contemporary context, because I think as things go on, people like us will be confronted with different but in some ways comparable situations where we're going to face really tough decisions around those things. At this point, the world is changing more dramatically than at any point in the 30 years that I've been alive. And I think that there's this old contrast that I think dates back to Rosa Luxemburg between socialism and barbarism. And I think that that contrast is as plausible now as it has ever been in the past. And it seems to me that a careful assessment, understanding of this sort of global transformation, whether it be in Seattle or Quebec or Genoa or on September 11th or the occupation of Iraq, or who knows what comes next, whether it's Syria or Iran or the Philippines or Colombia. If we don't understand those things, we're going to be unable to develop we're going to be unable to develop our efforts to create a liberatory movement, a revolutionary moment, and a free society. And those are the three things that I want people to concentrate on. Fascism, in my understanding, is built on a dialectic of backwards and forwards, of nostalgia and progress. And these two are always in tension with each other inside fascism, but the tension is productive for fascism, that is, in a way that most of us underestimate and that makes it far more dangerous than a lot of us realize. If we see only the regressive aspects of fascism, it can make us blind to the really, truly modern appeal that fascism has to a lot of people. And if we see only the progressive elements, it can make it difficult to distinguish between fascism and capitalism in the state as we know it today. While white supremacy has historically been the sort of the hallmark of fascism, it's what people associate with fascism, at least with major fascist groupings, this has not always been the case. And from my perspective, racial purity has almost always been a secondary or derivative characteristic of fascism. I think it's conditioned by and dependent upon what I want to call hypertrophied patriarchy. And that is total social and cultural totalitarianism built at its root on total male supremacy in the home and in society is what I think is the essential component that unites different otherwise competing strands of fascism. But over this sort of ideological essence, fascists have adopted a really crazy array of political positions that I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with. We've already seen fascists attempt to infiltrate the anti-capitalist, anti-globalization movements, and we know that a lot of fascists, although certainly not all of them, actually supported the September 11th attacks because they felt like it was a blow to the mainstream of decadent North American society or whatever. A lot of those positions tend frighteningly close to popular left positions on the same subjects. Obviously not the endorsement of September 11th, but the underlying analysis in some ways of being opposed to the mainstream of U.S. society from a very different perspective. And because we as anti-fascists too often think of the fascists themselves as sort of brainless thugs, it's really hard for us to figure out what's going on. And one of the main things I want to get across today is that we really need to start trying to figure out what is going on inside fascism, because that's going to be a major part of our figuring out what we can do to stop it. Possibly the most easily understood example of this sort of leftward tilting fascism, or at least seemingly leftward tilting fascism, is the support of groups like the National Alliance, which is the largest fascist group in the United States. And the NA has, in the last year or two, really taken this vocal public stance in support of Palestinian liberation, and obviously against Israel and against Jews and that sort of thing. The cover of the book that I mentioned earlier features an image of Nazis protesting in Washington, D.C. last May outside the Israeli consulate. There were a series of rallies that the National Alliance sponsored, most at the Israeli consulate, one of them at the U.S. Capitol, with this sort of political line being put forward. And certainly a lot of this support and a lot of the people who attended those rallies, the support is opportunistic posturing and the anti-Semitic equivalent of the Popular Front strategy, that there isn't really a solid meaningful support for Palestinian liberation on the part of most of the people who attend these rallies. But I think that when you look at the way the rallies get designed and who comes to them, that there is at least a solid core of ideologues inside and around the National Alliance who really do sincerely support their vision, which is pretty different from our vision, of Palestinian liberation. And that is sort of a troublesome thing, I think, for a lot of people on the left, and rightly so. The bigger problem, though, beyond just this core of ideologues, is the possibility that these rallies and this attempt will really resonate with a lot of a range of people, not only with with Nazis, but also with white liberals or moderates who are, you know, rightly pissed off about the treatment of the Palestinians by the Israelis, but don't have a solid analysis of what causes it and what it's about. And also by elements in the Palestinian movement, whether they're Islamist or not, that have that have incorporated notions of racial or ethnic purity into their analysis. In each of these cases, the majority of the people in those groupings, whether they be Nazis or white liberals or Palestinian movement people, that the majority of those people have, they don't even have an analysis, much less an actual real-life practice that can challenge or understand or critique the sort of patriarchal underpinnings of that kind of alliance that they might be walking into. And that, I think, is a really dangerous thing. But then the question is, can we generalize anything meaningful from the experience of a couple hundred people in Washington, D.C. last spring? And, you know, it's possible that these rallies in D.C. are really just sort of the old school of fascism with a slightly new veneer. But even then, somebody like Jason Kai, who's got the second long essay in this book, argues that we, as anti-fascists, underestimate the sophistication of the old school of fascism. And he goes back and talks about, you know, Italian and German fascism and demonstrates the weird twists and turns that it took in itself and sort of says that these kinds of things should not surprise us. They're nothing new. But the other possibility is we could consider the people who put together those rallies in D.C. to be sort of a bridge between an old 20th century fascism and a new 21st century fascism with its own novel and independent visions of progress and nostalgia in the new millennium that are different from those in the old. Don Hammerquist, the author of the other long essay in here, describes in good detail the real danger of new fascism, if that's what we think it is, the real danger lies in its adaptability to capitalist crisis, basically. Fascism, like the left, is a product of the development of capitalism. And capitalism's long history of crisis and development and crisis again and development again produces fascist movements in the same way that it produces, well, not in exactly the same way, but in some of the same ways that it produces left-wing popular movements like the ones that we participate in. And in an age of global capital that we are increasingly becoming aware of, historical linchpins of capitalism may become obsolete and may transform themselves. For instance, and a key example in this context is white supremacy. It's possible, some people think that it's likely, that as the 21st century develops, capitalism will cease to have a use for white supremacy as we've known it in North America for the last 300 years. That it will be a hindrance to profit rather than the prerequisite of profit. An interesting example of that is in the States, there are a number of affirmative action lawsuits at universities, at elite public universities in the States, that are before the Supreme Court right now. And almost every Fortune 500 company based in the United States has weighed in on the side of affirmative action, which is kind of surprising when you think about it. But if they perceive a need to build a managerial elite and an ownership elite that is multiracial, multinational, global in context, then that makes sense for them. But fascism has this progressive moment that really looks at that and says, wow, this is a new thing, and it's a crisis for capitalism, and it gives us a potential in for organizing and for work. And at the same time, its nostalgic moment says, hold on, we have to protect the privileges of white skin. We have to maintain our people, our nation's benefits. And that, I think, is one of the most important sort of contrasts inside fascism right now. And I think that one increasingly likely outcome of these sorts of tensions inside fascism is a defense of racial purity or racial separatism in contrast, at least in the fascist self-perception, in contrast to racial supremacy as such. And the idea is sort of, if you can't beat them, join them. And in that context, it's worth looking at a range of fascist websites that in recent years have put people like Che Guevara on their websites or have quoted them in their newspapers. As these mutations develop and new formations come into being, it's going to be worth asking whether fascism is the right word for this sort of stuff. It may be a new and different thing entirely, but in this talk and in general when I talk about these things, I use the word fascism because the historical context makes that word fit. It may not fit in 5 years, 10 years, but right now I think it still is useful for framing the historical discussion, so I continue to use it. But regardless, these are the sorts of issues that liberals and not-so-liberals in the U.S. between the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League, they talk about a left-right convergence of extremes. And a lot of that talk is opportunistic and should be opposed and rejected, but there is a kernel of something going on there that needs to be dealt with, especially by anarchists and militant anti-fascists. And I think most leftists just sort of flatly refuse to even consider that possibility. The left-right convergence of extremes is, they think, is never possible. But for those of us who, decline to underestimate our enemies, there's a different question that we have to address. And that question, I think, is if we can see fascisms that are revolutionary, and we can see fascisms that are anti-capitalist, and we can see fascisms that are anti-imperialist, we can see fascisms that are ecologically minded, and so on. And each of those, I think, if you think about it individually, probably no one in this room would deny that each of those individually can exist. But if they all can exist, then the question becomes, okay, so what's so bad about fascism? And for Stalinists, the answer may very well be, not too much. And I think that, historically is developed in groups like, there's a group in Europe mostly called the National Bolshevik Tendency that openly advocates a red-brown alliance between the brown shirts and red communists. And that is a logical outcome of these sorts of weird convergences. But for anarchism, for revolutionary feminism, for radical queers, for revolutionary anti-fascists, the answer, obviously, to that question, is it really so bad, is hell yes. But then we have to figure out why. And I think the answer is relatively simple, but it's not necessarily obvious. And for me, the answer is that our vision of a free society and of the movement that can bring that free society into existence is very broad, and it involves social and sexual experimentation. It involves clashes and mixtures of cultures and traditions. It involves creative efforts, music, art of various origins. It involves reproductive freedom. It involves a diversity of backgrounds and interests. It involves cooperation amongst strangers, freedom of movement, all the things that get called globalization from below. In short, a revolutionary and liberatory culture is at the heart of all of our best efforts, of everyone in this room. And we aren't necessarily hedonists, although there are some people in the movement who are. But what we are most certainly are not Puritans. And for this basic reason, there's really no permutation of fascism that can become the ally of people who hold that vision at the heart of what we do. And that, I think, is the important thing that distinguishes us from the fascists and should be advocated more strongly, deeply, and openly in the broader left. At the same point, it's equally important to recognize the corresponding issues that make capitalism, which is still the far likelier alternative to fascism at this point in time, that make capitalism really so bad in the same context that fascism is really so bad. And in this context, the current situation in the U.S. in particular has to be understood correctly, I think. There's been a lot of debate over the true cause of the war in Iraq and the war on terror, and I don't think any of it has been conclusive yet, but it's good that that debate is happening. But it's important to remember that the interests of capitalism are not only opposed to our interests as popular left movements from below, but are also legitimately opposed to the interests of the fascists. And in the States, the fascists in the last 5-10 years have suffered significantly more domestic repression at the hands of the U.S. government than any non-Arab section of the left in the States. In Chicago, for instance, the fascist organization that Anti-Racist Action has most strongly opposed is the World Church of the Creator. And the head of the World Church of the Creator is now in prison. Well, he's in the MCC, the jail, the federal jail, awaiting trial on conspiracy to hire for murder. And that's a prime example, I think, of the sort of repression that the state and capitalism impose not only against our side, but against the fascists. Here's where I want to talk a little bit about nations, because I said that I would do that, and because it's been a key topic of mine over the years. The key thing that I want to stress is that nationalisms have widely varying self-perceptions of what constitutes their nationalism. Some nationalisms are built around rigid biological notions of sort of essence and historical purity, and that those things are heritable. They can be passed down through a bloodline. And those are, I think, very closely related to that hypertrophied patriarchy that I was talking about before, because it's the essential requirement for that heritability, that passing it down through the bloodline, is that women and children know their proper biological place. And because of that, I think those forms of nationalism have strong overlaps with fascism. The clearest example of that, I think, is Nazi Germany, but there are examples all across the world, and including in the Third World. There are other sorts of nationalisms that are more culturally based, that identify essential cultural aspects of the nation, whether they be music or art or food or language. And those things can be adopted or learned or obtained by anyone, regardless of their parentage. That's a better situation, obviously, than the bloodline analysis, I think. But even in that context, you still end up with a sort of latent potential for a fascist tendency within that nationalism, even if there are official pronouncements to the contrary from inside the national movement or whatever that say, we are anti-fascists. And that potential is especially heightened in nationalisms of that sort, cultural nationalisms, that place sort of compulsory emphasis on the role of women and children in teaching and learning those cultural aspects, because that buys back into the patriarchal aspects that I talked about before. I think the best that can be hoped for in cases like that is recognition of and a public discussion of the fascist potential in those tendencies, and a rejection of them, and a commitment to struggle against them openly. But at the same time, there are, I think, we can see a small number, few, far between, depressingly small in size, of nationalisms that not only have that recognition, but really do actively struggle in a way more or less comparable to revolutionary anti-fascism. I think the Zapatistas are the best example of that, but there are other examples around the world that I think are worth looking at. And those groups really do incorporate revolutionary anti-fascism into their organizing in a way that I think is positive and productive and basically to be encouraged. But in the end, I think the key is that to be successful anti-fascists means being revolutionary anti-fascists. And to be revolutionary anti-fascists means being steadfast advocates and practitioners. We have to have both an analysis and a practice that advocates and enacts freedom, creativity, diversity, resistance, and cooperation. Those are key elements that I think can't be forgotten. And there's no guarantee of a free society, but there are some necessities, and I think those are among those necessities. And I want to come to a conclusion by giving a couple of concrete examples from work in Chicago. In Chicago, Anti-Racist Action has developed a pretty solid working alliance with a small Palestine solidarity organization called Al Auda. And Al Auda is a national U.S. I don't know if they exist in Canada or not. It's the Coalition for the Right of Return for Palestinians. And in Chicago, the Al Auda group is perhaps unique and certainly unusual in that it contains several fervent anti-nationalist Palestinians and that their specific vision and what they advocate, their points of unity, are, they have a line about a free, democratic, and pluralistic Palestinian society. There are enough anti-statists in the group that they got rid of not only two-state but also one-state solutions as what they advocate publicly. At any rate, ARA and Al Auda have developed a solid working relationship. ARA helped provide security for a large rally for the right of return that Al Auda organized last fall in Chicago. There were several thousand people there. And around the same time, members of Al Auda helped organize in the Midwest to get people to go protest against the National Alliance rally last August in Washington, D.C. And that was a really important thing because they were saying, we are Palestinians and we reject any connection with your supposed efforts on behalf of, whatever Palestinian, your vision of Palestine. And I think that the most interesting thing here for me is that that grouping Al Auda it has its own problems and internal issues, but the vision that they put forward that they enact as a group, I think puts them squarely at odds with even the most fervently and sincerely anti-imperialist versions of fascism, whether those people, those fascists, are members of the National Alliance or members of Hamas or of whatever organization or whatever tendency. The other thing ARA has done, or attempted to do at least with some success in the last couple of years, is build ties with the Mexican and Polish communities, which are the two largest immigrant communities in Chicago. And especially we've tried to do that in sort of youth and subcultural scenes like punk and hip-hop. And I do have to say that there is Polish hip-hop, and it's not that bad. Most ARA leaflets are trilingual, English, Polish, Spanish. At rallies that ARA calls, there is almost always a speaker in each of those three languages. We've done some work also in Arabic with the help of people from Al Auda. And we've also attempted to maintain connections with various groupings of radical queers and activist artists and politicized sports fans. The sort of ARA's reputation for fighting the Nazis notwithstanding, the bulk of what ARA in Chicago has done in the last couple of years has been cultural work. And I think that's a good thing, although at the same time, I don't think there's anything wrong with, fighting the fascists. I want to make that clear. I'm not opposed to that. No one in Chicago ARA is opposed to fighting the Nazis. We just think it's only part of the work that needs to be done. The question remains, how successful can this anti-fascist cultural work be if we are working and are involved in predominantly different communities and cultures and classes than where the fascists themselves are recruiting. And the main area of overlap in that context is the Polish community, where there are active Nazis recruiting and active anti-fascists doing work. But there isn't much of a Mexican fascist scene at this point. I don't think it's a crazy idea to envision that happening at some point in the future, but it doesn't exist in Chicago, at least right now. So I wanted to close with some sort of nice quote. I was looking through my Lynton Quincy Johnson albums, and I was looking through this Cuban hip-hop group called Orishas, and I was going to try and find some like cool cultural mixture kind of militant quote, and I couldn't really find anything that fit. And then I realized that today is May 18th, which is Bakunin's birthday, and I decided that I would end with a quote from a dead white European male that can remind us of not so much, like a lot of this talk has been about what we're for and what we support, but I want to remind us at the end of what it is that we oppose. And there's this great quote from Bakunin that says, "The state, as I have said, is basically a vast cemetery wherein every manifestation of individual and local life, every interest of those parties who together constitute society, is sacrificed, dies, and is buried." And I think that the open question is, what's the best way to oppose and overthrow that sort of cemetery concept, whether it's in a capitalist version or in a fascist version? And that's an open question, but that's why I wanted to end and ask you for your answers to all of these questions that I put forward, and any questions you have.